Support for today's episode of Script Apart comes from We Screenplay. If you just completed a draft of a script and are wondering what next, well, you need to check out We Screenplay. We Screenplay not only offers amazing free resources, like virtual events where your questions are answered by Hollywood's leading professionals, with incredible 72-hour turnaround, format-specific feedback tailored to your specific goals, and a price that no one else can come close to, We Screenplay coverage is used by thousands of writers in every phase of their careers, from emerging writers still finding their voice all the way to Oscar winners. So if your script is all ready to go, check out one of We Screenplay's labs, where dozens of writers have been repped, optioned, and staffed as a direct result of the real-life industry meetings and hands-on workshops offered by We Screenplay. Don't stay stuck. We Screenplay want to help. Check out We Screenplay by visiting wescreenplay.com or clicking the link in today's show notes. Support for this episode also comes from our friends at Screencraft. Breaking into Hollywood as an aspiring writer can be a confusing, convoluted thing. Fortunately, Screencraft is here to help writers with both the craft of writing and the business of Hollywood. Screencraft has everything for your writing journey, from video lectures starring your favorite writers to hands-on career coaching with their excellent writer development team. These guys offer the best screenwriting competitions designed to help your talent shine, featuring judges that really know their genre, from top literary reps to Oscar-winning screenwriters. Hundreds of past winners and finalists have started their careers with the direct support of Screencraft. Winners have been staffed on shows at Netflix, Amazon, Apple TV+, the list goes on. They've also sold scripts and been hired to write films for the likes of Universal, Lionsgate, Blumhouse, and Hulu. So if you're an aspiring writer, what are you waiting for? Don't wait to check out Screencraft today. Visit screencraft.org or click the link in today's show notes. Hey everyone, how are we all doing today? My name's Al Horner and you're listening to Script Apart, a podcast about the first draft secrets of great movies and TV shows. Today on the show, a movie in which Emma Stone attempts to punch a baby by a storyteller whose stories never fail to pack a punch. Yes, acclaimed playwright and screenwriter Tony McNamara is here, talking all things Poor Things. Poor Things is, of course, Tony's latest collaboration with the acclaimed director Yorgos Lanthimos, having previously worked together on the 10-time Oscar-nominated historical comedy The Favourite. This new film of theirs is a Frankensteinian creation as beguiling and impossible to pin down as its main character Bella Baxter herself. It's part coming-of-age odyssey, part gobsmackingly deranged comedy. It's a part travelogue, wandering through an eye-popping steampunk planet both like and unlike our own. You might also classify it, finally, as a father-daughter drama. Except here, the father is a mad scientist played by Willem Dafoe, whose home is a cornucopia of unholy experiments, his daughter being one of them. Emma Stone is astounding as Bella, a reanimated dead woman whose body, dragged from the Thames, has had life breathed into it once more. The horny journey of self-discovery that the character goes on from there, adapted from a 1992 novel by the Scottish author Alistair Gray, is one I never wanted to end. I've watched it a few times and I'll level with you guys, this movie is a thing of near obsession for me right now. I can't stop thinking about it, nor listening to its soundtrack, which is also amazing. All of which means it's a pleasure to present my chat with Tony, an Australian talent whose other screen credits include the TV show The Great, loosely based on Empress Catherine the Great of Russia's rise to power in 18th century St. Petersburg. He also co-wrote 2021's Cruella, which had no business being as good as it was in my opinion, a ripping 1970s punk heist movie inside a piece of Disney IP extension. In the conversation you're about to hear, we talk about our culture's, let's be honest, male-driven obsession with control, which the film functions as a commentary on. We get into who Bella Baxter is and the changes to Gray's novel that he and Yorgos made. Also discussed is the idea of sex as a liberating force for Bella, and what each land that Bella journeys to is meant to represent in her own personal journey. Thanks to Tony for being a fantastic guest, and a massive thank you to our Patreon supporters for helping make this episode possible. If you're not yet a member of that community, you can get involved by visiting patreon.com/scriptapart, where if you enjoy this show, there are all sorts of perks waiting for you. I'm talking ad-free episodes, early access to episodes, the chance to ask your questions to upcoming guests, and more. That address again, in case you'd like to get involved, it's patreon.com/scriptapart. Okay, with that all out the way, let's jump in, shall we? This is the fantastic Tony McNamara discussing the first draft secrets of Poor Things. Thanks everyone for tuning in. You're listening to Script Apart, hosted by me, Al Horner, produced by Camille Demek. Tony McNamara, welcome to Script Apart. How's it going today?
It's going very well. Lovely day in London, so seems great.
It is indeed. You brought the weather with you, so thank you for that. And thank you for Poor Things, Tony. I loved this story with every fibre of my being. I'm curious, did you have a similar reaction to this tale when you first read the novel, Tony? Let's begin there. Take me back to that first read through, when it was, where it was, and what kind of spell it put you under.
Well, I think it was 2007. I think it was sort of just before we'd shot The Favourite, maybe a year before. And Yorgos gave it to me and was like, he told me about it before. And I think he went to see Alistair. He'd sent it to me because he was on his way to see Alistair in Scotland. And then I read it and I did love it. It's such an extraordinary book. But it's not really obvious how you would adapt it. So I was like, of course I'll do it. I don't know how to do it yet, but we'll work it out. So I think that was my first reaction was, it was sort of like, what an extraordinary story, what an extraordinary combination of genres. There was so much in it. It's actually quite a big book, and it was so brilliantly funny and sort of weird and kind of like it had a particular structure, which I loved, but knew I couldn't do that for the movie. Or I knew I didn't want to do that for the movie. So, yeah, that was my first one. And then we had lunch and he's like, will you do it? And I'm like, yeah, let's do it.
Yeah, that makes sense. You know, I can hazard a guess or two as to what appealed to you about Poor Things, just from what I know about the rest of your work, Tony. You're evidently a storyteller who seems to love a period piece backdrop and love even more kind of upending a lot of the expectations we have of that particular period. So The Great, The Favourite, even Cruella, none of those are stories that you expect them to be. None of them kind of cling to the historic facts that you expect them to cling to. Poor Things fits into that strand of your storytelling. Can you tell me like the other ways in which Alistair Gray's story kind of felt in line with your preoccupations as a storyteller?
Well, I think it's funny when you're a storyteller, you don't even know your own preoccupations, I think. Now I mean, I do know that it's about, and I do know I often write about people who are very independent of spirit and are sort of finding their way within a very difficult, controlled situation. Like this, their set of circumstance and the people around them are very like locking them into an idea of who they should be. And controlling them. And I think, and their struggle to get out of that, you know, even Emma's character in The Favourite, that's what I built the whole thing around in a way, was the idea of her quest to be safe because her circumstances were controlled to such a degree. So I think it had that I liked, and I loved the kind of very European coming of age kind of thing amongst this sort of political, you know, the book has a lot of Scottish nationalism in it.
It does, yeah.
And I knew we sort of, you know, with apologies to all the Scottish people, I knew we couldn't bring that. We weren't going to bring that to the movie. But it's still, and I think it's just an extraordinary mind that you're working with. He was such an extraordinary kind of writer that, you know, you're kind of like working with stuff that's great. And that also, I think I knew Yorgos and I wouldn't be, we didn't feel we had to be faithful. I don't think he thought we were ever going to be faithful. We were faithful to his spirit, I think. And that was that's always more important to me. It's like, get to the spirit of it. It doesn't matter about the details to me anyway. If you get all the details right and you get the spirit of the thing wrong, I don't see the point of that.
And what was your articulation then, Tony, of what the spirit of Poor Things was?
I think it was this sort of, that was this movie about objectification and about male control of everyone, themselves, each other. Like, and that seemed a very human story. Is like, why do we control each other all the time? Why can't we fucking leave each other alone? and it seems like now, I mean, this was 7 years ago. I mean, even more so now, like the idea of controlling the other person's opinion and controlling everyone's what everyone has to say or how they want to live or their bodies or all of that seemed, not that we thought about that because we don't really think like that when we do stuff, but I kind of look at, when I watch the movie now, I'm like, oh yeah, some of that aspects of life are there in the movie, you know.
That's interesting. Yeah, because of course the novel was released, what, like 92? It sounds from what you were just saying there that maybe it was perhaps afterwards that you realized the kind of modern echoes, the kind of reasons for this story to be retold in 2023. It is a time right now, as you kind of alluded to there, of huge conversation around female agency, sexual liberation, the dangerous tendencies of men who kind of crave control of women, all those things. Do you think that was bleeding through then from modern day into your script, just in terms of what's been in the discourse these last few years?
I guess so. I think that's the thing. You can't have I think it's that thing sometimes, you know, if you write a movie or a TV show, or you have a producer or someone, they can often go, oh, this is what's current now. It should be about that. And you're like, well, see you in 7 years when we release it. we'll see what's current then, shall we? So I think that's that's why I think I never think about it. You know, I just literally, I only work with the characters and situation I have, and then whatever I guess is in my reaction to the world comes through in some way, but it's not very conscious. I try to be I'm a very simple screenwriter in that I keep things incredibly simple for myself in terms of how I approach things. So I literally approach things from what a characters want and why, and I almost don't think about and what's in the way, and then from then I don't think about it. I don't think about anything.
Was there anything you think you were able to bring from your own life in terms of like the journey towards finding herself that we see Bella going on in this movie? Like, from what I know of your adolescence, Tony, you had all these different jobs and experiences that you flitted between while finding your calling. It was on a trip to Rome, from the sounds of things, that you decided to become a writer, for instance. There are obviously going to be quite a lot of differences between your experience and Bella's, but it does sound similar in some regards to the way that kind of travel unlocks in Bella a better understanding of herself in Poor Things.
I think so. I think for everybody. I mean, I guess for a young country kid from Australia who grew up, you know, I grew up in a small town in Australia and in the country, and not super country, it's more like a small town, but it was dairy farms and racehorses and stuff. Then it was like a big journey to come to Europe and work in London. And I really didn't know what I was doing, and I didn't, but I did know I always wanted to get somewhere. So I think with Bella in the same way, it's like, I don't really know what I want, but I know if I go on a journey, the journey will impact me, and my interaction with the world will make me define myself. So in that sense, yeah, it has some similarity, I guess, if I think about it.
So what did give you the grip that you needed on the character of Bella? Like, I'm curious if there was a particular phrase or a particular reference point that kind of like unlocked her for you on the page. As a viewer, I think when I watched it the first time, something clicked into place for me early on in the film when I began to understand her character as almost like an Alice in Wonderland lost in a Frankenstein myth. And yeah, I wonder whether there was a kind of a similar kind of reductive starting point that began as that was your beginning point for understanding the character.
The character sort of informed a bit as it went along, but I think I always just went, I just thought about where she wanted to end up, which was she wanted to be free and understand who she was, but in the process she would create herself. And that's where she would end up, realizing she wasn't trying to find out who she was creating herself. And once I knew that, it was pretty good. And then It was informed. I mean, the book informed it, obviously. And then, and strangely, I had a, well, he's eight now, but I had a two-year-old at the time. And occasionally he would do things or say things. And we would, I would kind of tell Yorgos these little things he would say. And we put a, and so there was a sort of like, which helped us with the aggression, because early on she was too nice. And I was like, oh, I've got little kids. They're not too nice. So we brought a little more of that, a little edge of that, which helped help the character a fair bit. But I think it's that. I think we just were always informing it, thinking about, and the language. For me, language is always key. How people talk is a big thing. In a sense, I keep everything simple. Maybe I accept that. You know, I work hard to understand what people's language is, and then I work hard to create the rhythm of that and the and how that will work. And for her, it was interesting because it had to evolve, and it had to evolve at certain times in the movie, in a way, you know. And that was kind of tricky, because it was sort of like her language here is too much, or she's too evolved here, but she's not enough. But she has to be relatively evolved, because in our heads she's 15 or 16 there. But so we sort of had that. We did a lot of, you know, with Yorgos, I did a lot of like, we would tweak moments into making sure we felt like the rhythm of all that was right.
You mentioned there the language of Bella being different, being too nice in the first draft. What else was different in that first draft, Tony?
The first draft was quite difficult, because you're choosing your events and you're choosing your characters and the weight of things. So it's the big draft, really. But he's always like, I just remember it coming out really great. But I remember writing to him at about page 70 going, I don't know that I can do this. It's too hard. And he wrote back going, I know it's hard, but we know it's going to be worth it. I'm like, okay. So we finished it. No, there weren't much. He was right. It was the first, from the first draft, I think a lot of it was to do with the sections and the journey of the sections and how, what would happen in each section and what the journey of each section kind of, for me anyway, we don't talk heaps about it, but it was more like there's too much event here and there's not enough there. And what did Paris, how to get out of Paris, how to get home, and what would happen, what was home. The biggest change in the whole drafting process was maybe we were a fair way in. We'd done like, which for us is like three drafts in 3 years or something. And we didn't like the third act. And then, because in the third act, the husband took her at gunpoint out of the church. And I think it was a bit like the book, I think. And then he's like, it doesn't really work. And then we talked about it for a while. And then I kind of went, what if we do, you know, I was like, what if we do this? What if I try, she chooses to go. And he's like, okay, try it. And then we liked it. And then we just tweaked the third act for a while. But yeah, that was the biggest change from drafting. The biggest structural change was that one. Otherwise, we were always pretty happy. And it was about rhythm and language and what happens here and how we were going to show Alexandria. And because that was so tricky in terms of how to write it, how to like, it's tonally such a gear shift in the movie. So that was a very tricky thing about how to get through that. And, but yeah.
So all the big departures, you know, for example, like the kind of transposing of the setting from Glasgow to London, the kind of losing of some of the kind of First World War allusions that are on the margins in the novel, all that stuff happened at outline phase, and you knew going into that first draft structurally what it was going to be. It was just a case of tweaking for the most part by the sounds of things.
Yeah, I think for me a lot of it's like, Michael Arndt has a really good phrase about it, which is something like, it's about finding the mountain. You can't climb the mountain until you find the right mountain. And I think I can't start until there's a bunch of things that I have to be clear about. And I think for me, that was a lot of it. It was like, for me, I thought, let's set it in 1880 or whatever. Then we talked about Glasgow for a little bit, And then I can't remember why, but we felt like we would set it in London instead, which you know, for the Scot, I mean, it's just a shame because he's such a great Scottish writer that, which was why Willem has a Scottish accent, you know, that was our nod as such. But so those things, and then, yeah, because the book's got so much and that is about adaptation, having done a few, you've got to, and even The Favourite, you know, you just got to strip down. Because a movie's not long. 2 hours is not a long time to tell a story, you know, other than sometimes it feels like it when you're watching them. In terms of putting a story together that's going to have enough, you've just got to really understand what goes in and what goes out and how to strip out stuff so that you're not – there was already a lot to deal with. They're quite hard films like this because a journey film is hard. Because you're meeting new characters all the time. You kind of like, yes, you're carrying, we carry Duncan as sort of the whole movie. And that was the other thing we decided to, I think I decided because we went with Bella, I was like, I think we have to go back to London. Like we have to intercut back. And then I was like, well, what are they doing? Well, they're grieving, but also, Aren't they sort of fucked up guys who would just be like, let's create another one, which I thought was really funny. And because I didn't want to lose in a movie, you don't want to lose your characters. And I didn't want to go back to them an hour and a quarter after we'd seen them. So there was a lot of practical choices about audience going with you in the sense of she left at the 25-minute mark and we got back to her. And you got back to London an hour and a half later. It's like, I can't even fucking remember who they were. So there had to be a sort of B story, for to want of a boring word, that would carry the audience, that they knew that story was continuing, that they knew there was a line, that she wasn't just floating free in the world. Because I think that wouldn't have worked, which is why I sort of invented the whole let's create a new version. And it felt right because they were grieving and the dumb guys who don't know how to deal with grief and love and all that kind of stuff seemed kind of good to me. You know, I kind of felt like I knew that story.
Dumb guys, that's a pertinent phrase. Like a running thread through pretty much every section of the film seems to be that the men she encounters are almost as childlike as Bella without the reason to be. Like they're immature simply by virtue of their insecurities, their pettiness, their egos. That's obviously by design, Tony. Can you talk to me about that, about some of these male characters and what they were each designed to bring out in Bella?
Well, I think they were all to be versions of, they, you know, they're all different. I mean, Rami's character's kind of a good guy, more or less, except he's too weak to kind of, he's quite weak in a way at the start. And then, you know, and Duncan's the classic tropey cad who I thought would be funny to kind of rip him apart through his own, he's put himself in a position he usually puts the woman in, you know. So I kind of was just interested in that they would all control her and some of it would be for actual, you know, genuine love. And that it was a complicated kind of control, but it was control of the same. And for all of them, even, you know, Sweeney at the brothel, that it wasn't just men, it was just like everyone was trying to control everyone. And I think that was partly my thing. It was like, it's one of those weird things about human beings is we spend all our time, well, so much of modern life anyways, people trying to control each other. And then control their opinions, control people's bodies, control like fucking what you're allowed to say and what you're not allowed to say, control like, you know, money and economic power. So it felt like, geez, I think I was a bit like, oh, well, you know, it was a good story to tell that story, you know, in a way. Later, you know, I kind of wrote it all before I sort of saw any of that. But I think the men characters are like, they're sort of like fools I have empathy for in the same way I have empathy for all of, you know, I think I like having empathy for every character. I never write anyone. I don't write any character thinking they're awful. I think they're fucked up or what they want they don't understand how to get what they want, or the way they're going about what they want is idiotic or whatever. But I think they're all something. There was the father figure of Willem's character, and then there was, you know, Rami was the innocent love, and then the cad, and she also walked into these experiences kind of knowing, in a way, like she says about Duncan, you know, I fear he'll do me damage, but I'm prepared to, you know, go have it done or whatever to see what that is. I felt like that's good too, because I didn't want to, it was also that thing of like giving people agency within these interactions, you know, and that she would bounce off the world and create herself in the way we all do, for better or worse.
Yeah, and her tool for that liberation, her tool for taking that agency for herself, is often sex. And, the sex scenes in this movie are explicit because they're explicit in their importance to her coming of age. Like, in a world where Bella initially has no control over her life, her discovery of being able to take pleasure from her body becomes like a form of defiance, a form of rebellion, a form of like self-ownership, like from the very beginning when she learns to masturbate. I'm curious, like, what some of your conversations were around that and how far to push the envelope, because it's a real running thread in the film.
We didn't have too many conversations about it. We end up being quite practical about how much there is we talked about. And, you know, I think we always knew it would be a big part of it, because it's a part of the book. And it was always like that would lead her into, that was part of anyone's coming of age, is your understanding you have a sexuality, as you understand you have a instinct for independence, as you understand you have a brain that can engage with ideas, and could actually, there can be some degree of liberation and self-creation through all those things. And I guess that was it. And that was how we viewed it. And then it came in certain stages, in a way. The idea of her family being adventurers triggered it. And then this idea of her sexuality being something she wasn't even allowed in the house made her want to leave. And then from there, it became like, from that, that led her into, well, there's a world that's interesting to me in an external sense. And then on the boat, it becomes, oh, my brain could be interesting, and that I don't understand the world. And then it's like, okay, the world's this fucking thing. How do I deal with that? And then the brothel became like, oh, well, I don't have the value system everyone's shown. You know, the society's value system is something I wasn't indoctrinated with. So I don't really understand this kind of sex, what sex is good and what sex is bad and what is wrong. But within the context of the brothel, she tries to make her own rules, and she tries to like, and eventually goes, okay, there's a difference between that and being used. And at the same, you know, so I guess there was this, it was always a thread that went through it. And then I guess the last third of the movie, that sort of gets left behind, and it's more about how she's going to define herself in different ways.
That's interesting. So it sounds like, from what you're saying there, that each section was almost, it was almost about introducing a new worldview for her to have to grapple with, and then moving on to the next one. So maybe we could break that down a little bit, Tony. So obviously we begin in London. I love the opening section of the film. I love how it immerses us into that world. Can you tell me about like what you had to get right in the opening pages in terms of how to establish the world, how to maintain that like note of intrigue? It's kind of quite pointed that the film begins with this very dramatic moonlit leap from a bridge, but it doesn't immediately answer how Bella came to be in Godwin's care, like what the relationship is there, how she seems so developmentally challenged, why that is. Talk to me first about the London section, and then maybe we can move through the others.
I guess the London section, the elements that I think we needed to know, it was just about what we needed to know while just telling her story. And I guess it was like, how do we, and then it was also, how do we show that it's kind of going to be funny? It was sort of like set up that he's a surgeon, but he's got this deformity and you don't know why. And he's got this girl in the house and you don't know why. And then you bring in Rami's character to help some of that information in a weird way. as well as beginning to create that triangle, that he, Rami's going to sort of open the door a little bit for her. And so those things, and then it was sort of like, I think one of the things that did develop over time was her engage. I don't think at the start she was in the lab stabbing people's eyes out. I think I just, you know, the doctor thing, and I was like, oh, well, let's try and work that back. And so and also that was the thing that I do think we played with a little bit, which was how we were going to tell the audience the story of how she got there and when we were going to tell it. And I think probably, to be honest, I think the first draft we told it all straight away, maybe. I think at some point it was right up the front, and then we probably moved it a couple of times, and to kind of get, and then the end, because it was sort of like, where do we land it? But in the end, through Rami investigating was the way to land it within, so it didn't feel like just fucking information dump.
One thing I love about that section that I think, you know, speaks to the humor that's introduced, there's this kind of like symmetry between the kind of beautiful patchwork grotesquerie of some of Godwin's experiments, all the kind of mad little hybrid animals running around his townhouse, and the film itself. Like the film itself is mashing together genres and tones the way that those animals are kind of hybrids of different things. I should also ask, I suppose, about like, yeah, Lisbon. The Lisbon section is when we start to see that self-actualization from Bella, partly through Duncan, but it's more complicated than that.
Yeah, it's partly through Duncan, and the sex gets her out there, and the idea of an adventure as much as anything. But then it becomes getting lost in Lisbon was a whole that also that she's not going to be kept at all quickly. She's not going to be controlled at all. She's going to be, and then it was like, then I was like, oh, well, how will we get her on the boat? Because it was also about how do I link sections. So I think it was once Duncan realized he couldn't control this kind of wild spirit, who he didn't quite understand why she didn't understand the world, because he was not interested enough in her. Then it was like, okay, so once she's like, oh, I'm on an adventure and you're part of it, but you're not it. Then it was like, okay, well, screenwriter way, I have to get her on the boat. So how do I get her on the boat? Well, control. He wants to get her on the boat. So I was like, came up with he just puts her in a trunk and has her put on the boat. But then it is like, she then knows she's being controlled. So then there's a defiance about that on the boat. And then that leads us into meeting other people who expand her. And that's the first idea of the mind rather than the body, which is Marta's speech about, at her age, she's more worried about what's between her head than her legs. And then that leads you her to start reading books and him getting more annoyed. So then it becomes for her like, oh, okay, I was a child. It's like a realization of naivety and selfishness. And it's like, how do I, but I always wanted her to have an optimism about people. I wanted her never to lose that, because I don't think she ever thought, even though Godwin controlled her, she never stopped loving Godwin, and she never sort of, so I always wanted this optimism about her, which I think is just me. I like optimistic characters. But so I think she left the boat a different person, and a fearless person who wanted to keep taking the world on. And then the brothel was important because it wasn't just men controlling her. It was economics and female, you know, there were other people who would control her, because I wanted the idea of, that's part of living in the world, is everyone on some level is trying to get what they want off each other. And that's our curse and just our fundamental nature. But for her, it didn't, she doesn't get that, you know, she doesn't like it. She's sort of, but then there was this sort of like, Sweeney became this weird philosophical mentor of how you become a whole person. You get degraded and you embrace awfulness and you kind of go through every experience. So then by the time she leaves, she's a bit like formed in a way. And it's like, what's the next part of my life? And the next part is London, going back to understand what happened to me and who I was, and create my new presence. And then the coming back of her ex-husband, and then it's like the danger of wanting to go find out who you were in the past as distinct from just living in your present where you've created yourself. And then the goat joke, which was, you know.
Well, we can come back to the goat joke, but like each of these kind of stages of development, were they modeled on like the actual kind of adolescent process? Because, for example, like the ocean liner section, it's not an accident, obviously, that she meets Harry, and Harry's such a cynic, and she kind of discovers for herself some of the injustices of the world, and it like points her towards a nihilism in that section that she hasn't come across before. And that really reminded me of like my teenage years and how like I dipped towards nihilism and how I was listening a lot to Rage Against the Machine and so on and so forth. But yeah, like, so can you tell me the degree to which you were consciously mapping out onto Bella, like the ages of adolescence and the kind of things you go through at those times?
I think I wasn't conscious, but I sort of knew roughly that felt early 20s to me. Whereas Lisbon felt like 17, 18 to me, you know. And so I kind of had that, even though I knew, you know, there was the idea we were fast tracking her through to 30. So there was always like, she, wherever she started, I kind of remember what we thought. Maybe she was 7 or 8 or something. And then she was quickly up to 16 or 17, 17 by the time she left. And then she was like, by the time she gets through the boat, she's like 22, 23. And then Paris, she's like 27 by the time she leaves. And so by the time she finishes the movie, she's like what she would have been, which is like 30. So there was a rough idea that, yes, you go through those phases in life. So so there was some consciousness to it. I mean, I don't do it consciously when I'm writing scenes or anything. I think in my head, I was like, oh, we should roughly know that. And it came, and also for language, was creating the form of the language and rhythmically making sure each section changed enough and how much. And we had a lot of conversations about that where it was like, I think that word's too much for that. And that sentence, she's too grown up there and it's fully formed and it's proper. And I was like, well, we'll start to drift those in, and but we'll keep some of this. And which Duncan says to her, you're losing your delightful way of speaking, you know. So there was that, the rhythm of the language, the formation of the language kept changing throughout the movie as well.
And you mentioned the third act was maybe the hardest to crack. It is a fantastic third act. I love how, you know, in a film about male control or men trying to control women, Alfie Blessington is almost like the male control final boss. Can you talk to me about like that character and what he kind of had to represent in terms of Bella pushing back against those who wanted to strip her of her autonomy? He explicitly wants to strip her of her sexuality, which he sees as being key to her autonomy. So yeah, can you talk to me about that and how you approached that section and also the goat joke, how it all had to culminate in that goat joke?
It was in the first draft. I said to him, I finished it in this way. I hope you like it. Read it and started laughing because, okay. The third thing, it was tricky in the sense that it's hard to bring in, journey films are hard because you bring in a character, and that's why I think Chris did such a good job. It's hard to like land in a movie that's been going 100 minutes and you've got to introduce a new character to the audience they don't know. B, you've got to create a world she lived in that it made sense why she left. And I went back and forth on that, because I was like, should it be much nicer than we think it will be? And then I did that for a while, and Yorgos and I talked about it, and we kind of went, it was sort of the more unexpected choice, was that she'd go somewhere and it'd be super nice and you couldn't work out why she left. But in the end, I think it was more fun, and it felt like to step up into the third act that he should sort of be the pinnacle of he's slightly mad. Like, I wanted him to be sort of fucking PTSD mad. And we did, in fact, have a great PTSD scene between them that didn't make it. But
what happened in that?
Oh, they kind of had this late night conversation where you sort of understood their marriage a bit more. but it was really funny and weird. But I think it just made the movie too long, but I liked it. So I think he had to represent a sort of violent, physically violent, but also the sex organ thing, that he wants to remove her sexuality, he wants to control it, wants to use it for babies. And all in this slightly, but you also had to get a sense that she was probably as appalling as him. You know, they were probably an appalling couple. And she was monstered by him, and she was not a nice person. And then we sort of had to make it funny. And then I was like, I want to make the world, so maybe I'll make it that the servants and him have a weird codependent relationship, that where they sort of deal with each other in this weird way. So it was sort of that. I think that's what I mean about hard. It's hard because you have to reset a world. And the first few sections are easier because, not easier, because you're carrying Duncan through three quarters of the movie. So he's giving you something other than just Bella. And so she's not there just floating in the wind, and you're getting this other story of Godwin back at home. But then that all disappears. So the third act was sort of them until she goes back to Max with his body. So I think I was always nervous about it, because it's sort of like a big, you have to set the world, you have to get the audience to buy in. Yeah, you know, and I mean, it's great. I mean, I thought Chris was fantastic, but because he just bought it. No, it was a sort of stepped up level of fucking madness, which was great, which I really liked. And even in the writing, that's what I wanted. I was like, okay, let's have him fucking, he has to have a gun in all times, or the servants will fucking kill him. So it was sort of that idea, really, of this sort of gated, the house is great. And so, yeah, it was sort of like how to make her make a very dangerous choice and make it feel to the audience like, oh, I don't quite know that this won't go the wrong way.
But it ends up with her triumph over Alfie coinciding with these other triumphs for her. She has this beautiful goodbye with Godwin, and she kind of inherits, you know, his scientific mantle, if you like. Can you talk to me about that and the sort of like the end point for the character, where it felt fitting to leave Bella's journey?
I think it felt fitting where she knew what she wanted to do. Godwin, she got to say goodbye to their relationship and understand it was a complicated relationship, and she could not forgive bits of it and still have it. And I think, you know, she's got Rami. So that felt like all of that felt good. And then that she tried to go and understand who she was and realized it didn't matter. Who she'd been in the past didn't matter. So it was now about self-creation on the next phase. And then we can't, you know, came up with this idea of having that group of people who were all people who'd been more or less in controlled situation, you know. Even Rami was controlled by Baxter, you know. So it was sort of that, so that she kind of had this independent group. And then, you know, the goat joke was a way for me of going, because by right she should kill him.
Yeah.
And the idea was she doesn't, because she believes people can be improved, and she believes if you don't control everybody, then maybe there's freedom. Maybe there's a way for us to be independent of each other without this desperate desire to manipulate all the time. So, and I think all the people on the balcony at the end are sort of not people like that. So they're all people who are just trying to make their way, and they don't have that need on other people. And so that's sort of where it felt like a good place to end, and it seemed like the goat joke was a good way out.
help me work something out. I've pondered on the title a lot, Poor Things, and how it kind of connects to everything we've been discussing. What does that phrase mean to you? Why do you think that's the it feels so appropriate? Why is that?
I don't know. I don't know what Alistair, why he called it that. I never met him to ask him, unfortunately. But, and I've never asked Yorgos whether he asked him, but to me it always meant fucking humans, poor things. That's what it means to me. It's like, fucking, what a fucking thing we are.
Yeah, tell me about it. Well, on that slightly pessimistic note, we should start to wrap this up, Tony. I love this film so much, and yeah, I'm a big fan of your work, I should say. Like, you know, The Favourite, The Great, even like Cruella, like I loved Cruella as well. Like, can you tell me like what we've got to look forward to coming up from you, Tony? Like, I'm aware that you were vaguely attached to be working again with Emma on Cruella 2. Can you tell me if that's still happening and what else might be in the pipeline for you?
What else is in the pipeline? I'm adapting a book for Yorgos, which we've done, which we're I think on one of the drafts, second, third draft. So yeah, a sort of can't really talk about that, or he'll get mad at me. So I'm adapting a book for him. I've got making a sort of marriage comedy film in the next year, and then I've just got some. I've got a few a new TV thing, and but a few things. Just a bit of TV and a bit of movies, really. And yeah, I did work on Cruella 2 for a bit. Yeah, but I'd work with Emma any day of the week. I mean, I've had 5 months off strike, so we're just getting started again.
Well, I can't wait for all of that, Tony. Thank you so much for taking the time today, man. I've had such a blast chatting with you, and congrats again on Poor Things. I love this movie.
Great. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Script Apart. Thank you so much for tuning in. A reminder that if you want to help the show continue to grow, you can join us on Patreon by visiting patreon.com/scriptapart or clicking the link in today's show notes. Thanks again for joining us. We'll see you next time.